I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Annie Jacobson, author of Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. We'll also have a visit from our Two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Last week was Israel's Independence Day, Yom HaAtzmaut, and for the occasion, I was asked about the failure of the recent U.S.-led peace talks and if I personally believed that ultimately there would ever be peace between Israelis and Palestinians. I must say I was surprised that Secretary of State John Kerry got as far as he did in the current climate in the Middle East, and I have said so previously right here on Too Jewish. But I cannot honestly say that the collapse of these talks should have surprised anybody. Peace in the Middle East has been an elusive goal for many, many years, and I never anticipated that these talks would get even as far as they got. Allow me to explain. In my opinion, in order for any sustainable peace deals to take place in the Middle East, particularly between Arabs and Jews, there are three conditions that need to exist. First, both sides must have leaders who have a fair amount of confidence that they are in control of their own nation's political direction. No one can successfully negotiate a transformative peace treaty from a position of weakness, and any such agreement will not receive the support it must have to succeed. Israel is a true democracy, and if it were to negotiate a peace with the Palestinians that did not have the support of at least 50% of its voting public, that treaty would certainly fail. The Palestinians are theoretically democratic, too, and their own public will not likely support any treaty with Israel that's viewed as unequal or imposed upon them. Currently, the Israeli government is a patchwork coalition between the pro-peace moderates of Yesh Atid and its leader Yair Lapid, the pro-settlement religious Zionists of Habayit HaYehudi, the Jewish home, and its leader Naftali Bennett, and the right-wing Likud party and its leader Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu. It appears to me that while this government can make progress on many fronts, economic, eliminating the yeshiva deferment problem, and so on, the one thing it simply cannot possibly agree on is any sort of final status treaty with the Palestinians. Without all three parties, this government falls. There are new elections, and it all starts over again. Right now in this government, one party is very willing to give up territories for an agreement. A second party is focused on keeping the West Bank as part of the eternal homeland of Israel, and the third party has exactly no trust for Palestinians at any time. Where can they possibly come together on any land for peace deal? On the Palestinian side, as we've often said, President Mahmoud Abbas, the former Abu Mazen, leads only the Fatah faction of the Palestinians and mostly just in the West Bank, not the Islamist Hamas. And he knows that any courageous step he makes towards peace is very, very likely to get him assassinated by Hamas terrorists. Abbas is walking a fine line, and he has never shown the ability to make such dangerous decisions for the possibility of peace. In fact, Abbas has never really looked like a leader who can make any such deal, and this time is no exception. The second condition that needs to exist for Middle East peace treaties to work is that both sides must fear that a failure to reach some agreement will be worse than the agreement itself. In other words, it takes a certain measure of desperation on both sides for any durable agreement to be made. This was true for Egypt and Israel after the Yom Kippur War, when Sadat and Begin created the very first real Israeli-Arab peace treaty. A peace that, in spite of many trials and deficiencies, still endures 35 years later. It was true when the Oslo process followed the First Intifada, and Israel and Jordan created a variety of still valid and important agreements. And I do believe that it will prove to be true someday for Palestinians and Israelis. The Oslo Accords failed because the Palestinians became more confident and less desperate and turned from negotiation to terrorism yet again. This time around, the Palestinian leadership isn't totally desperate. It does have big problems, and it cannot feel too confident about the meltdowns that have taken place in Egypt and Syria, making them much less helpful patrons. But the Palestinians are not truly desperate. And the Israelis, well, they're not really desperate at all, with a still strong economy and no existential military threat except Iran. The border fence is ugly and an unpleasant propaganda tool for the Arabs, but it has essentially stopped Palestinian terrorism in almost all of Israel. So, no Israeli desperation. You need both carrot and stick. And right now, for both sides, there really is no stick. And the carrot. The third condition for real peace is that both sides in such a Middle East agreement must be willing to make serious, tangible compromises, even sacrifices, in exchange for what amounts to promises. This means that whatever land Israel agrees to give the Palestinians, and whatever changes the Palestinians agree to make in their rhetoric, their transparency, their educational system, someone has to make it clear that there is a concomitant benefit to be achieved, and that there is a guarantor, somebody guaranteeing that benefit with economic aid, political muscle, and real dedication. Currently, the only player who can provide that sort of guarantee is the U.S., and the current administration has not demonstrated a great deal of, shall we say, stick-to-itiveness in its foreign policy. Israelis and Palestinians alike can watch the Ukraine being dismantled and have good reason to doubt that the long arm of America or NATO simply won't reach to the shores of the Mediterranean. Whatever carrots are being offered don't come with any real guarantees. So I guess I just don't believe that peace between Israel and the Palestinians is going to happen soon. It's a pity, and the truth is that the sides aren't really that far apart. Well, at least we can pray for peace and sing about it. To play us in this morning, here's a classic Shir LeShalom, the song of peace sung by Shiri Maimon. Star of X Factor Israel these days, by the way. That was Shiri Maimon singing Shir LeShalom, a song of peace. Our guest this morning has explored one of the most remarkable and troubling untold stories of the Holocaust and the post-war period. Annie Jacobson is the author of Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. And you'll hear this remarkable tale when we return on Too Jewish.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU, dream it, do it, visit asu.edu.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Two Jewish our guest this morning. She's author Annie Jacobson. Her new book is called Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, as a journalist, what provoked you to explore this largely hidden area of history, particularly as it relates to the German scientists who came here under all kinds of interesting programs?
Well, I was actually working on an earlier book called Area 51 when I came across Operation Paperclip, and I was fascinated by the program. I was researching weapons systems that were borrowed from the Nazis, copied from the Nazis, and specifically two aircraft engineers named the Horton brothers. They had been overlooked for Paperclip, but I learned very quickly that their boss, Colonel Siegfried Knaemeyer, came to the United States and worked for the U.S. Air Force starting in 1947. So Knaemeyer was part of Paperclip. When I learned that Knaemeyer retired from the Department of Defense in the mid-70s, he was given the Distinguished Service Civilian Award, the highest award that the Department of Defense can give a non-deuniformed person. And knowing, as I did, that Knaemeyer was chief technical scientist in the Luftwaffe during the war, and that he was so important to Hermann Göring that Göring called him my boy, I thought to myself, how does this work? How does an individual, scientist or not, go from being so important to the German Air Force during that war to being so important to the Pentagon during the Cold War? And that really began my interest in Paperclip.
You know, it's fascinating. I remember as a kid listening to Tom Lehrer sing about Wernher von Braun. You know, the man whose allegiance was ruled by expedience, but he was scarcely the only one. How many German scientists were involved in this program?
Well, the number as it stands now is approximately 1,600, although I don't believe that's any kind of an accurate number. That's just what exists in the National Archives. So many of the stories have been classified for so long. A couple that I write about, a couple of the individuals that I profile, were completely unknown to have been part of Paperclip at all. But that gives you a good idea of, that it was hardly a small program.
1,600. We will talk much more with Annie Jacobson. It's a fascinating story, Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought so many Nazi scientists to the United States and helped in the Cold War, I suppose, when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world is certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's TOOJewishRadio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, streaming them there, or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcast. The Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going just a month from today, June 11th to June 23rd, 2014. If you're interested in coming on this fantastic journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to Jerusalem, please email twojewishradio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, was 2 weeks ago, but there continue to be untold stories from that terrible time, and we had a reminder last week. Last week, a guy named David Stoliar, the sole survivor of a tragic 1942 Russian torpedo attack on the SS Struma ship that killed 781 refugee Jews, died in Bend, Oregon last week at the age of 91. It is quite a story. The SS Struma was an old wreck of a ship on which 60 Beitar Zionist youths were attempting to rescue over 700 desperate Romanian Jewish passengers who were fleeing the Nazis in the death camps and trying to immigrate to Palestine. This is in 1942, in the midst of World War II. A combination of the decrepit condition of the ship and its failing engines, the refusal of the Turkish authorities to allow the refugees to land in Istanbul, and, most of all, the British government's absolute refusal to allow any Jews into mandatory Palestine because of fears of Arab hostility, all helped lead to the slaughter of all the passengers, save Dave Stoliar. I can even see it. If I force myself, I can see being in the water and the Turkish boat coming, Stoliar said during a 2013 interview about the February 24, 1942 sinking of the SS Struma, which occurred when he was just 19 years old. The boat, after a troubled trip out of Romania, her engines didn't really work, the ship was towed out of the harbor by a tugboat, somehow managed to make it to Turkish waters. After several weeks of failed diplomatic negotiations with the passengers on starvation rations on the Struma, the Turks finally decided to rid themselves of the embarrassment of nearly 800 Jews in a 75-year-old hulk of a boat in Istanbul harbor. With her engines continuing to fail, the Struma was towed out into the Black Sea, where, shortly thereafter, a Soviet submarine torpedoed her, part of a Russian policy then of sinking all ships that might be carrying material that the Nazis could use. The Struma had just two leaky lifeboats, and only young David Stoliar survived, clinging to an iron door. All the other Jews on board died. Stoliar is regarded as a historical figure. He was featured in at least three books and one movie, but he never liked to talk about the incident known as the Holocaust at Sea. I'd never heard him talk about it until we'd been married for 2 years, Marta Stoliar, his second wife, said. I found out later he never told his first wife either. They were married for 17 years. We were hanging onto all kinds of debris that was still in the water, Stoliar recounted. That was very early in the morning. By the evening, people disappeared, drowning. By night, I was by myself. Stoliar grew up in Chisinev, Romania, and was 18 when the Axis-aligned Romanian government started persecuting and murdering its Jewish citizens. The 10 weeks that the 19-year-old Stoliar spent aboard the doomed Struma, and later upon his rescue in a Turkish prison, were deeply scarring. After each time he agreed to be interviewed, whether by officials from the Holocaust Museum in Washington or by reporters, he would wake up screaming at night. There were more famous voyages of the damned, such as the MS St. Louis, and there were other Jewish refugee ships torpedoed after the Struma, like the Turkish ship the Mefkure, but the Struma was a profoundly tragic incident, and its last survivor, David Stoliar, has passed away. In addition to his miraculous survival back in 42, Stoliar was fluent in 8 languages and ran a shoe manufacturing company in Oregon. He also had a continental fashion sense. He was a proud, elegant gentleman who dressed in vanilla pants and shirts from Europe, his wife Marta said, by far the best-dressed man in Bend, Oregon. That was his life, the best of everything. May Stoliar's memory be a blessing, and may the remembrance of this awful tragedy remind us that when we Jews most needed any kind of international assistance, the world closed all its doors and allowed us to die. No matter how much we believe in international cooperation, the truth is that Israel is the only country that has never turned its back on desperate Jews fleeing anti-Semitism and murder. We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, and Chag Atzmaut Sameach.
Chag Atzmaut Sameach, a happy Israeli Independence Day. By the way, that's a hard thing for Americans to say, Yom Ha'atzma'ut. They like to say Passover. It's simple. but we should learn how to say it. Tell us a little bit about how Israeli Independence Day is celebrated in Israel.
Yeah, I would say that for the week before also, like, you could see a lot of flags and people, you know, it create the environment or atmosphere. Or
flags everywhere, blue and white, lots of singing.
Yeah, people even put them on the car, whatever, they are putting everywhere
decorations,
flags
everywhere.
And you know, the uniqueness is that on Yom HaZikaron, when we commemorate our soldiers and victims of terror, and we actually spending 24 hours really understanding that only because of them, and of course week before with Yom HaShoah, we can live almost in peace in Israel. And there is a very unique and important ceremony, the transition ceremony, exactly like at the moment that, you know, we are moving from Yom HaZikaron to Yom HaAtzmaut. And traditionally, we are reading, like on Har Herzl, we are reading the Silver Platter poem.
Silver Platter on Mount Herzl, the sort of... Oh, that's where the cemetery is. That's where of the Herzl
plaza
himself,
yeah,
of some of the most important Israelis. Mm-hmm. And that poem by Natan Alterman talks about how no state is given. It's quoting Chaim Weizmann: "No state is given a nation on a silver platter.
Uh-huh.
It was earned by the sacrifice of the young people who fought."
Yeah, yeah. And at the end of the poem, it says, "We are the soldiers," like the dead soldiers say, "We are the silver platter." And it's very touchy, I'd say, very moving and
very
powerful.
So there's a sadness, a sense of responsibility that maybe Americans don't always have on the 4th of July. We have a little bit of that on Memorial Day, but not in the same way Israelis do.
Yeah.
But
we have the same barbecue for Yom HaAtzmaut,
yeah,
like 4th of July. Yeah, yeah. At least we have something similar.
We barbecue at the same time, and we put up flags, and we play music.
Yeah.
And I understand Israeli entertainers make their fortune on Yom HaAtzmaut.
Big time.
concert after concert.
Yeah, they're running from city to city, Eilat to Metula, yeah.
Singing all of the Israeli songs.
Mm-hmm.
Here in America, we celebrate Yom HaAtzmaut. Jews celebrate it, but lots of non-Jews come and join us to celebrate Israel's Independence Day because of the tremendous support for Israel in America.
Yeah.
What should we know about Yom HaAtzmaut here that we don't always know? What should Americans be celebrating that isn't always celebrated here?
First of all, it's like a miracle that, you know, we're having this, we're having Israel, and we're keeping, you know, contribute the world a lot of our invention and helping not just the Jews, but all. So I think everyone, not just the Jews, need to be very happy that we have Israel. And yeah, and it's really, for me, like for the first time, it's really very, very, it touched my heart to see all the support. And I'm getting all kind of emails and posts on my Facebook this morning that I'm Christian by tradition, but I have only
love for
Jews and for Israel. And this year, and like this week on Wednesday, we will have Israel celebration at the JCC, and also they next day Kufi, the Christian for Israel, also celebrate in Israel on Thursday. So
lots of support for Israel. Chag Ha'atzmaut Sameach. Yeah. A wonderful holiday. Thanks, Oshrat. When we come back on To Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
You know, we're in the period of the counting of the Omer between Passover and Shavuot. And before we zoom off to many other topics, we're taking a look back at Pesach a couple weeks in our rearview mirror now. We were talking before we began this discussion about your Seders, and one passage struck you in particular.
Right. So we use the New American Haggadah, which is wonderful in many ways.
That's the Jonathan Safran Foer and Nathan Englander and a bunch of other
right.
people.
And Lemony Snicket. Right. It's got a lot of great text. It has a translation that bothers a lot of people.
Right.
But
it's got some really great stuff.
Right. So it's an interesting and very engaging Haggadah that people of all ages and generations can relate to. But one thing that wasn't commented on in their footnotes, explanations, etc., that I noticed for the first time, and obviously I've been attending Seders for a really long time, and one of the great things
Tom.
One of the great things about Passover Seders, and you know, it's two a year, every year, and I'm well over 50, so I've been at well over 100. One of the great things about Pesach and Judaism in general and studying Torah is that you never exhaust the possibilities of learning. You know, the saying, Hafoch bo v'hafoch bo ki yakobo.
Tachulaba, right. It's all in there.
Turn it around and turn it around and turn it around because everything's there. So the passage that generated a lively discussion this year was Tse Ulmad, go out and learn. Why doesn't it say Lech Ulmad, go and learn? Like go to school or go to the house of study or go to shul and learn. Okay. So my take on that
was... And why
was,
does it say go out as opposed to go to the typical place?
Say, go out.
Right.
So my take on that was that that's one of the key themes of Passover, which is that in order to accomplish real learning or real liberation of the self, you have to go out of your comfort zone. You have to go out of the little box in which you normally live and put yourself in some new, possibly uncomfortable territory. But you have to go out of the familiar places or the familiar circles of people, challenge yourself, learn, grow, and achieve some kind of self-liberation. And I think really that's one of the key messages of this wonderful holiday we just celebrated.
And you know, I think it can be carried forward because this whole period of the Sfirat Omer, the counting of the Omer, is to prepare yourself for Shavuot, but it's also to say that every day has meaning, every day has value, and each day is different.
Right. And I have to confess that Shavuot somehow is the one holiday I always forget. For some reason, it's very easy, and it shouldn't be that way because that was giving of Torah at Mount Sinai. I mean, it commemorates...
Covenant, it's so central.
Right,
but
it's
like... Well, it's only one day or 2 days outside of Israel, and you know, you're not... Well, we'll talk about this as we get closer to Shavuot.
Right. Sukkot lasts 8 days, and it's a big deal because you sit in the sukkah, and Pesach lasts 8 days, and it's a big deal because you have Seder.
And food.
And the high holidays are big deals because
they're a big deal, and they're 10 days apart.
Bookend
and
the 10 days of repentance, whatever.
Right.
But Shavuot, it's like, what do? You eat blintzes. I mean, you know, it's easy to forget, especially if you're on a diet.
Stay up late and study.
Right.
Thanks, Tom. Well, we will explore that as we get closer at the end of this Omer period. But for now, Tseu Lamad. Go out and learn.
I look forward to it. Thanks.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One evening, as Rebecca is tucking her son Sammy into bed, a flash of lightning lights up the room, and a loud clap of thunder follows. She hopes Sammy won't react to the storm, is about to turn off the light when Sammy asks in a frightened voice, "Mommy, can you sleep with me tonight?" Rebecca smiles and gives Sammy a big comforting hug. "I can't, Bobola," she says. "I have to sleep in Daddy's room." After a moment of silence, Sammy says in a shaky voice, "That big sissy." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. And now a word of Torah. This week in Temple, we complete the reading of the book of Leviticus with a portion of the Torah known as Bechukotai. At the end of a book that is focused on holiness and its rituals of sanctification and celebration, we conclude our exploration with a statement of covenant. God says, "If you keep these, my laws of holiness, you will long flourish in the land that I will give you." It's a promise based on action. If we live lives dedicated to holiness, our actions will bring blessing. We have the capacity to create a world that has meaning and goodness. But you know, holiness is a strange idea. In Judaism, holiness is usually something that we create, not something given to us from above or from the outside. A little example to demonstrate how it is we create holiness. A sheepskin is certainly not a holy object, right? Where I'm from originally, in Southern California, you use it to cover up your car seats, especially if you have a convertible. Nothing very holy about that. So what happens if you take that sheepskin, remove the hair, cure it into parchment? Is it holy now? No, it's just a piece of parchment. But if you take that parchment and give it to a sofer, a scribe, who writes on it a section of the text of a Torah, and if that piece of parchment is now sewn together with other texts, and if that whole parchment roll is wrapped around wooden atzei chaim, wooden poles, and if it's dedicated and carried around a synagogue and chanted from publicly, and blessings are said over it, and it's used for bar and bat mitzvahs and touched and kissed with the fringes of a tallis, well, now that piece of parchment has become something more. It has become holy through our own actions. We have taken a common object, a sheepskin that we could have used for any number of uses, even a college or high school diploma, and created out of it an object that is sacred, really holy, a Torah. The abiding lesson of Leviticus is that we have the capacity to make our own lives holy, sacred, in a similar way. We can lead lives that are ordinary and prosaic, or we can choose to live truly holy lives. That choice is, in fact, an ethical one. We make that choice every day, sometimes every hour, when we decide how we are going to act. When we give freely of ourselves, as Leviticus asks, we increase holiness in the world, and we give our lives beauty, meaning, and sanctity. In a couple of moments, Annie Jacobson, the author of Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America, will explain how this remarkable program that brought people who might today be considered war criminals to the service of the U.S. government functioned, and why it mattered. Find out when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU, dream it, do it. Visit asu.edu.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Continuing a story we've been following here on Two Jewish, Cornelius Gurlitt, the German recluse who captured the world's attention after it was revealed that for decades he had hidden a collection of 19th and 20th century European masterworks amassed by his collector father under the Nazis in his Munich apartment, died last week at the age of 81. Gurlitt died without known heirs, leaving questions about what will become of all this art. Some of it in the custody of the German government, some of it still in his possession, and some of it subject to Jewish restitution claims. Outrage flared last November after the German newsweekly Focus broke the story of Gurlitt's collection, and the German authorities' failure to reveal the existence of approximately, get this, 1,280 paintings and drawings by artists including Chagall, Picasso, Matisse, Max Beckmann, and many more, confiscated from his apartment. Some of the works were unknown, never having been entered in the international art catalogs. Gurlitt's spokesman, Stefan Holzinger, said that it would be up to the court to determine whether there is a valid will or contract of inheritance. Under Bavarian law, if there is no such contract, that is, will, a court will be appointed to decide who can inherit Gurlitt's property. The artworks were seized in a tax evasion investigation in February of 2012 from the apartment where Gurlitt had lived quietly for decades, occasionally selling a painting for money, but otherwise hoarding a collection assembled by his father, Hildebrand Gurlitt, one of just four dealers allowed under the Nazis to buy and sell the modern or degenerate art they officially despised. Many works in the Gurlitt collection were plundered from German museums, but scores belonged to Jewish collectors who were forced to sell their art way below market value as they tried to flee the Nazis, or simply had them confiscated before or after being expelled and murdered. After the collection came to light in the fall, authorities in Bavaria and embarrassed officials in Berlin turned the job of investigating provenance over to an international task force, which is continuing its investigation under an agreement reached a few weeks ago with Gurlitt. Hundreds of his artworks have been posted on a government website, lostart.de, but his lawyers say that only four claims have been received. To date, not one picture has been returned. German authorities have held the trove at an undisclosed location, citing security reasons. In February, an additional 238 more works were removed from Gurlitt's second home in Salzburg, Austria, and relocated also to an unnamed location. Gurlitt was last known to have sold a painting in December 2011 when The Lion Tamer by Max Beckmann fetched over $1 million at an auction in Cologne, Germany. The auction house Lempertz brokered an agreement for some of the money to go to the heirs of Albert Flechtheim, a Jewish art dealer forced to leave Germany who died a poor man in London in 1937. Although reporters from around the world camped outside his Munich apartment for weeks after the art collection was revealed, Gurlitt gave only one interview to Der Spiegel. In that conversation, he revealed almost nothing about his life, saying that the only thing he had loved were his pictures. His, huh? Gurlitt came from a family renowned for activities in music, art, and literature way back into the 19th century. His father was a quarter Jewish under the Nuremberg race laws, and he was dismissed from two museum posts by the Nazis, but he was also one of the few Germans granted permission by Joseph Goebbels, Hitler's propaganda chief, to sell confiscated art. Sales to foreign buyers filled Nazi coffers, but art historians have documented many sales in Germany as well as proceeds pocketed by the dealers. While Gurlitt insisted in the interview with Der Spiegel that he would not part with any of the works, the agreement he reached with the government officials paved the way for these looted works to be returned to their rightful owners, regardless of the ultimate fate of the larger Gurlitt collection.
Only a boy named David, only a little slave.
Only a boy named David, but he could pray and sing.
Only a boy named David, only a little brook. Only a boy named David, but five little stones he took.
And one little stone went in the sling, and the sling went around and round. And one little stone went in the sling, and the sling went around and round.
And round and round
and round and round and round
and round and round and round.
And one little stone went up in the air.
And the giant came tumbling down.
And the giant came tumbling down.
And the giant came tumbling down. Came tumbling down.
An Israeli archaeologist says he has found the legendary citadel captured by King David in his conquest of Jerusalem, rekindling a long-standing debate about using the Bible as a field guide to identify ancient ruins. The claim by Eli Shukran, like many claims in the field of biblical archaeology, has run into some criticism. It joins a string of announcements by Israeli archaeologists saying they have unearthed palaces of the legendary biblical King David, who is revered by us Jews for establishing Jerusalem as our central holy city, but who has long eluded historians looking for clear-cut evidence of his existence and reign. Shukran, who excavated at the Ir David, the City of David archaeological site, for nearly 20 years, says he believes strong evidence supports his theory. This is the citadel of King David, this is the citadel of Zion, and this is what King David took from the Jebusites, said Shukran, who said he recently left Israel's Antiquities Authority to work as a lecturer. The whole site we can compare to the Bible perfectly. Most archaeologists in Israel do not dispute that King David was a historical figure, and a written reference to the House of David, Beit David, was found in an archaeological site in northern Israel, but archaeologists are divided on whether the Davidic sites in Jerusalem are David's. Shukran's dig, which began in 1995, uncovered a massive fortification of 5-ton stones stacked 21 feet wide. Pottery shards dated the fortification walls to be 3,800 years old. They are the largest walls found in the region since the time of King Herod, the ambitious 1st century BCE builder who created the second Jewish temple complex that you see the remains of in Jerusalem at the Kotel. This Ir David fortification surrounded a water spring and is thought to have protected the ancient city's water source. Fortification was built 800 years before King David would have captured it from the Jebusites. Shukran says the biblical story of David's conquest of Jerusalem provides clues that point to this particular fortification as David's entry point into the city. And in other news, actually some rare good news from Iran. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has rejected a plan to ban the free text messaging service WhatsApp. That plan was approved by an Iranian censorship committee and announced by Abolsamad Haramabadi, head of the country's Committee for Determining Criminal Web Content. The reason for this ban is the assumption of WhatsApp by the Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, who is an American Zionist, Haramabadi said. Well, actually, Zuckerberg is an American Jew, which was kind of his point. Access to Twitter and Facebook and other social networks, as well as other websites, are often blocked by Iranian authorities. Iran does not ban Facebook, however. Rouhani has been active in recent months on both Facebook and Twitter. Iran's telecommunications minister, Mahmoud Vaezi, says that Rouhani has ordered a stop to the proposed ban of WhatsApp until there is something better to take its place. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We welcome back to Two Jewish. Our guest this morning, Annie Jacobson, is a journalist, author of the New York Times bestseller Area 51, a graduate of Princeton who lives in L.A. with her husband and two sons. Her new book, also destined to be a New York Times bestseller, is Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. We started to talk about the fact earlier that there was something like 1,600 identified Nazi scientists who were brought to the United States. You think that's not necessarily the tip of the iceberg, but probably not comprehensive. Tell us who the most important of those scientists were and what they had done in Germany before they were brought here.
Yes, well, of course, it depends how you define most important. I chose 21 individuals to focus on because I found their stories the most compelling. A number of their stories are also the most nefarious. And this is because the programs, the weapons programs that the U.S. was most interested in at the end of the Reich was the atomic, or rather were the atomic, biological, and chemical weapons programs.
Well, and of course the rockets too, right?
Yes, I mean, the V-2 rocket was raining down and sort of wreaking havoc across these major European cities, London and Paris and Antwerp, but really of concern because the V-2s were not terribly accurate, so they just sort of, wherever they landed, they, you know, wreaked havoc. But you couldn't specifically target Site X or Site Y. But the real concern was what else could be packed in the nose cone of that missile. And to the Allied intelligence, the real fear was chemical weapons or biological weapons. And those were very real fears because Hitler had advanced extraordinarily far in both of those mediums, further than we had.
So it seems clear that the Allies, well, the United States, had a conundrum on their hands at the end of the war. There were all of these Nazis that had fallen into their hands, and as you title one chapter, Hired or Hanged, they had to kind of decide, did they want to bring them over and incorporate them into the United States military program? Did they want to try them, which was a very difficult process involving creating or finding evidence, which was not necessarily easily at hand? You know, what were their options?
Well, absolutely. And so they were gathered about in this castle, ironically one of Goring's former Luftwaffe headquarters. It was called Castle Kranzberg, and it was just outside of Frankfurt in the Taunus Mountains. And these scientists were put in the castle, and there began the interrogations of them. And this part of my research I found particularly interesting, going through those original transcripts, some 12 pages, some 125 pages, and you see the Allied interrogators asking questions, and we read between the lines these German scientists really squirming, knowing full well that they could be hanged, perhaps, for some disclosure of some of the things they did, and then wanting to be hired. I mean, the American job was the job everybody wanted. Nobody wanted to go work for the Russians, and the British didn't have any money. And so you see this cat and mouse game of scientists giving up information, but only so much information.
I want to go back to maybe the most famous of these Nazi scientists, Wernher von Braun. Tell us a little bit about how the whole rocket program, you know, there's a chapter you entitle Science at Any Price. It seems like a lot of actions during the war were sort of instantly wiped away when certain scientists had valuable skills or knowledge. Tell us how that worked.
Von Braun was number one on the target list for these intelligence officers who were searching for scientists who could come to the United States. This program would later, of course, become Paperclip. And the reason he was number one was because he was the scientist on the V-2. What's fascinating about Von Braun's involvement in wartime crimes is that the U.S. government absolutely helped him from day one to whitewash his involvement. They almost didn't want to know. You see that in the transcripts of the communications with him. Von Braun was very clever, very crafty, was quite a Faustian character, made deals with the devil starting with Hitler and moving forward, because he certainly didn't mention the fact that, and this is really where his crimes lie, is in this underground tunnel facility called Nordhausen, which is where in the last 6, 8, 9 months of the war, the V-2 rockets were being assembled by slave laborers. So the Reich was pulling prisoners out of concentration camps, putting them to work in these underground weapons factories, and literally working them to death. Something like 30,000 slaves died in the Nordhausen tunnels where von Braun's rockets were being assembled. Now, many people in the decades, starting sort of in the 80s, when word came out that von Braun was in fact a member of the SS and that perhaps he did know some things. Many people would often say, well, he was just a scientist, he didn't know. But if there's this one document which is so chilling, which was actually found by the historian Michael Neufeld for von Braun's biography, and that is that von Braun himself went to the Buchenwald concentration camp and handpicked slaves who would work in his underground tunnel factory. And when you think about that, when you consider what von Braun saw at Buchenwald, it is impossible to excuse him from his Nazi past.
You know, it's kind of stunning, some of the revelations in this book. The first director of the Kennedy Space Center was actually an SS officer, Kurt Debus. The father of U.S. space medicine, Hubertus Strughold, was complicit in Nazi medical war crimes, and on and on. Otto Ambrus, Hitler's most important chemist, was restored to full status. There was a place called Camp King, run by the U.S. military and the U.S. Occupied zone in Germany, in which Nazi doctors, including the Reich's Surgeon General, Deputy Surgeon General, were actually in charge. Kind of scary stuff.
I mean, it was really astounding to research and report this and look in depth at the way in which these individual cases unfolded, because when you generalize them as just listening to you, it just seems almost impossible to believe. You know, that's got to be some kind of conspiratorial, it sounds apocryphal. But case by case, as I went through these files here in different archives, in Germany in different archives, working with the children of some of these high-ranking Third Reich party members who very courageously opened up their father's papers, long secret, long hidden, never shown before to a journalist. You know, I was able to document this, the specificity of these individual cases, which is just stunning. And I think, you know, Otto Ambrus, I'll just mention him for a moment, because no case was more horrifying than the case of Dr. Otto Ambrus. And, you know, he was Hitler's favorite chemist, and I don't say that lightly. I found in the National Archives a document that I don't believe was ever made public before, which showed that Hitler gave Ambrus a $1 million Reichsmarks bonus during the war. And that was because Ambrus did two important things for the Third Reich. He invented co-invented sarin gas, and the A in sarin stands for his name, Ambrus, and he invented synthetic rubber, Buna, it was called. And that, think of how important that was to the Third Reich. I mean, tanks need treads, aircraft needs wheels, and the Reich needed rubber. And so, you know, Ambrus was seen as this, you know, incredibly important scientist to Hitler. And then, not only that, he was put in charge of the slave labor factory at Auschwitz, which was called Buna. And for that, Otto Ambrus was put on trial. You know, we squeezed information from him initially and then sent him to the Nuremberg war crimes trial, where he was tried and convicted of mass murder and slavery. But lo and behold, Otto Ambrus was then given clemency by the U.S. High Commissioner of Germany, John McCloy. His finances were fully restored to him, and he wound up with a U.S. Department of Energy contract. This is just almost impossible to comprehend, and yet the documents show us that this absolutely happened.
You know, I have to add just one last point. By the way, it's a great reading book. These guys didn't do it for free. They may have been much happier to be with the U.S. military than they would have been working for the Russians. But they were paid, and some of them were paid pretty well. That seems, again, just a tremendous moral contradiction.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, many of them, and certainly some of the men that I write about, go on to live the American dream, reaching... Wernher von Braun was not the only one who reached quasi-celebrity status. And this really sort of gets you right to the heart of the matter when you think that these scientists, the majority of the 1,600 of them, were given that coveted American citizenship after the war, went on, lived the American dream, and in many cases, their obituaries lauded their hard work for the U.S. military, mentioning nothing of what had the truth about what they had been involved in the war, because, of course, that information was kept classified by the U.S. government.
I want to thank Annie Jacobson for a terrific visit here on Two Jewish. Her book is called Operation Paperclip, the secret intelligence program that brought Nazi scientists to America. And as much as we've covered, there is so much more in this book. It's exhaustively researched, but compellingly written. Annie, thank you for a great visit.
Thank you so much for having me.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Two Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Dr. Richard Ablin, inventor of the PSA test and the author of The Great Prostate Hoax. Our playout this morning comes from a truly classic Jewish choral composition, Louis Lewandowski's setting of the very musical 150th Psalm, sung by the Adat Ariel Choir of the Dat Temple in Los Angeles, celebrating the congregation's 75th anniversary this year. It's kind of the Jewish version of Handel's Messiah, if you will. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.